Chapter 9, How to Create an Insurgency, Part 2, Summer and Fall, 2003. It isn't clear that a large and persistent insurgency was inevitable. There is some evidence that Saddam Hussein's government knew it couldn't prevail conventionally, and some captured documents indicate that it may have intended some sort of subversion campaign against occupation. The distribution of arms caches, the revolutionary roots of the Ba'athist Party, and the movement of money and people to Syria either before or during the war all argue for some advanced planning for an insurgency. I believe Saddam Hussein always intended to fight an insurgency should Iraq fall, Major General Swanick Jr. said in November 2003. That's why you see so many of these arms caches out there in significant numbers all over the country. But the U.S. approach, both in occupation policy and military tactics, helped spur the insurgency and made it broader than it might have been. Every insurgency faces three basic challenges as it begins: arming, financing, and recruiting. A peculiarity of the war in Iraq is that the Iraqi insurgency appears to have had little difficulty in any of these areas, in part because of U.S. policy blunders. The missteps made in 2003 appear to be a major reason that the anti-U.S. forces burgeoned despite their narrow appeal, both geographically and ideologically. In the first area, arms, the unusual situation in Iraq favored the enemy. It was a land awash in weaponry and explosives, both in small collections distributed by Saddam Hussein's government before the U.S. invasion, and in huge dumps, some of them the size of small cities. In this area, policy decisions made at the Pentagon aided the nascent insurgency, because U.S. forces lacked the manpower to monitor the big dumps, let alone unearth the far-flung caches. Had the Iraqi military not been disbanded, it might have been used to cordon off those large caches. There certainly would have been some leakage, but less than occurred with no guards whatsoever in most places. Finance is a murkier area. But here, too, U.S. decisions appear to have unwittingly aided the enemy. Before and during the U.S. invasion, intelligence surveillance observed convoys of trucks and cars heading from Baghdad to Syria. At the time, there was some speculation that these were carrying weapons of mass destruction, or manuals and other technical knowledge related to their manufacture. In retrospect, it appears that many of those convoys actually were carrying top Ba'athists and their families, and their cash, gold, and other valuables, some of which later would be used to support the insurgency from outside the country. Yet about a year would pass before the U.S. military would launch a serious effort to gain control of Iraq's borders, a step that is a prerequisite to mounting an effective counterinsurgency campaign. But it was in the third area, recruiting, that the U.S. effort inadvertently gave the insurgency its biggest boost. Finding new members is usually the most difficult of tasks for the insurgent cause, especially in its first growth, because it requires its members to expose themselves somewhat to the public and to the police. U.S. policies, both military and civilian, helped solve that problem. The de-Ba'athification order created a class of disenfranchised, threatened leaders. But those leaders still needed rank-and-file members. The dissolution of the army gave them a manpower pool of tens of thousands of angry, unemployed soldiers. On top of that, the lack of U.S. drive and the sense of drift at the CPA gave the Ba'athists a much-needed breather.